This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, good morning, Tracy.
Good morning.
You know, it's nice to be back. I have been gone for a couple of weeks, haven't I?
It's been tough.
It's been a real whirlwind. And I was really happy to see that you had Dr. Sood, the meditation expert, as part of this program, because we have just moved from the bigger house to the little house, and that has been a stressful situation. And I need to talk to Dr. Sood.
Yeah, and your kids are both graduated now, so you're empty nesters for the first time. A lot of changes in your life.
Exactly. Well, Dr. Sood can help me get through this whole thing.
I
know. And you know what else we want to talk about? There is not an epidemic of Ebola in this country, at least not yet, but there is an epidemic of diabetes. The number of Americans with diabetes has increased over 50% since the early 1990s, and that number is projected to double over the next 15 to 20 years. Amazing. It's incredible, and a lot of it is related to, unfortunately, obesity. But here's what I find also interesting. It's also predicted that one-third of babies who are born today, one-third, 33%, will likely develop diabetes unless something changes, unless we figure out how to treat this a little better or avoid it or prevent it. And I think there's no better time to talk about diabetes than November, and that's because this is American Diabetes Month, as proclaimed by the American Diabetes Association. It is truly time to raise awareness about a huge health problem in America. And, you know, the experts say that diabetes has now become as important a health problem as smoking in this country.
Wow. Yeah. Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk with diabetes expert Dr. Adrian Vella. We'll find out why diabetes is increasing so dramatically. We'll find out about the complications that go along with it. Diabetes is the leading cause of blindness between the ages of 20 and 74, and it is the leading cause of kidney disease and the number one reason that people have amputations. And it increases your risk for stroke and heart disease. We'll find out who's at risk for diabetes, how they make the diagnosis, and what you can do to help ensure that you don't get it. Plus, speaking of eye disease, so it's Diabetes Awareness Month. It's also Diabetic Eye Disease Awareness Month, to go hand in hand with that.
A big month for
diabetes.
Yeah,
that's right. So we'll talk with eye disease specialist Dr. Sophie Bakri about the complications of diabetes related to our vision, or diabetic retinopathy.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting that diabetes, as we'll hear from Dr. Vella, affects the whole body, every cell in your body and every blood vessel in your body. So it's not just the blood vessels to your kidneys or your heart or your brain, but it's also the blood vessels to your eyes.
And
we'll talk about that with Dr. Bakri.
That's when you can first notice that or detect that you have diabetes is through an eye exam.
That's right.
Readers of Parents Magazine may have spotted a frequent guest of Mayo Clinic Radio on their most recent issue. The article is entitled Five Easy Ways to Meditate Every Day, and it is written for mothers of infants and toddlers. But trust me, when I say that it applies to everyone, I actually printed it out so that I could reread it a couple of times. Joining us is Dr. Amit Sood. He is the author of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. Good morning once again, Dr. Sood.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody.
Thank you. Good to have you with us. We're stressed. Help us.
He is very stressed. But I have to say, so this article in Parents Magazine, it is for toddlers and parents of toddlers and infants. But anybody who has a preteen in the home or a very active 9-year-old boy in the home, like I do, can find something out of this article as well. So the title is Five Easy Ways to Meditate. Is it really easy to meditate every day, Dr. Sood?
Well, meditation, if you define it in a most rigid way, then it is not easy to meditate. But if you loosen the definition a little bit, and if you call meditation just as moments of intentional attention, when you're choosing to be a little more compassionate than otherwise and a little more non-judgmental than otherwise, then you can be meditative all day long.
Intentional attention, is that what you said?
That's right.
Wow, very good. Some of the things that it says in here that I have to admit kind of made me laugh. There was one that said, you know, if your toddler is having a meltdown, what your mantra should be is, I am patient. And I would probably say it more like, I am patient. But how do I change it so that I really can kind of meditate my way through through those tough times of parenting?
Well, the mantra that I keep in my head, which really helps me, is that an expression other than love is a call for help. So if my toddler is melting down, and we have a 3.5-year-old, not really a toddler now, but she does still have meltdowns, then I just assume that there is something really hurting deep inside. And she's not trying to get me or being unreasonable. When I can focus on the root cause deeper behind, then we both get lifted from this experience, and I'm able to resolve it much faster. So I am patient is a very good mantra, which keeps me centered and focused so that I do not break out in an inflammatory response.
You have a great attitude.
He does. No, Dr. Shives was saying, you know, they just sold their house. They're newly empty nesters and lots of changes. Changes can bring stress in somebody's life, correct?
Absolutely. Stress is your struggle with what is, what was, or what might be. Stress is not having what you like or not liking what you have. So whenever you're experiencing change, in your case, Dr. Shives, one very good aspect is that you chose this change. So for a lot of people who are going through, say, financial crisis, these changes are imposed upon them. So if you look at it that, you know, I chose this, I chose all the, you know, downsizing, the way I'm looking at life, so I have more time now looking at my life rather than maintaining my house, then I think it'll engender lesser stress.
I'm feeling better already.
What is it that stress does to our bodies?
Oh, stress, basically, puts our body at war. Our body goes on towards fighting or in fright reaction. So it breaks down the body, it creates inflammation, it predisposes to atherosclerosis, heart attack, stroke, cancer, premature mortality. Stress ages you by about 10 to 15 years. Mm. It disrupts your GI system. So basically, pick any medical book, Tracy. Look at its index. Every condition you will see there is worsened by stress.
That's incredible, isn't it? Now, Dr. Sood, for the average person, male or female, who is working every day, has stress in their lives, doesn't really have that much time to meditate. I mean, what's your recommendation? What is it that each and every one of us can do every day to help relieve stress in a reasonable amount of time?
Yeah, that's what we are all about. We really want to make things that are practical and easy and real world. So I would mention three A's. The first A is awareness. So you become aware of what is stressing you. Are you spending too much time watching news? Are you catastrophizing that your child's grades are not really A-plus consistently? Are you overreacting to spilled milk on the dining table? So become aware of what is happening. Do you have demand, resource imbalance, lack of control, lack of meaning in your life? So, and of course, become aware of how your brain and mind operate, which is what we try to share with our patients and learners. So that is the first A. The second A is attention. So be a little more attentive to what is happening around you. Throughout our day, we can either be mind-wandering or can be focused. And what research shows that we spend bulk of our day with a wandering mind, where we are focusing on all the open files in our head. So instead of that, bring your attention to something simple and ordinary. Sprinkle it multiple times during the day. When you're dressing your child, just look at the color of the eyes of the child for a second and see the depth inside it. Don't wait for the double rainbow. Look at the cloud formation. Be there for the taste of the apple or the intricacies of Halloween costume that you saw yesterday. You can focus on breath or mantra or sound or image. So that is the attention piece. And whenever you see people, silently wish them well instead of judging them quickly. Third is attitude. I believe the greatest disability is having a negative attitude consistently, because there's really no good treatment for that. So reframe your attitude with some timeless principles such as gratitude, compassion, forgiveness, finding higher meaning through your life, and accepting what is.
Yeah, I think that people used to think meditation, you know, you had to go into a room for 90 minutes and just be quiet and be still. But meditation is, I think, as we're learning, is a lot easier than that and a lot easier to do throughout the day.
Absolutely. That was the case 3,000 years ago, when the world around was not very safe, and you had to internalize your attention to really come to that place of calm. The world outside now is so much more beautiful. We've created this wonderful world, beautiful world around us, and the world is overall much safer, despite the headline news that we sometimes see. So externalizing attention and finding those micro moments of intentional attention where you just choose to notice, those are your meditative moments.
All right. The book is called The Mayo Clinic Guide to Stress-Free Living. It would make an awesome Christmas present, I would just say, as a person who has read it and keeps rereading it. It's a great book, Dr. Shives.
All right. I've got to get into it. You have an app, too, don't you, Dr. Sood?
We do have a very simple meditation program. It's called the Mayo Clinic Meditation. It's an introductory app. And it's a simple, very low-intensity way of sort of getting introduced to this this topic.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Dr. Sood. We appreciate your time.
All right.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Good morning. Time for a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with diabetes specialist Dr. Adrian Vella. And a little later in the hour, we'll talk with diabetic eye disease specialist Dr. Sophie Bakri. Plus, myth or matter of fact, children can outgrow diabetes. Myth or matter of fact, we'll get the answer coming up.
And right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our expert at 507-282-1234. Or you can tweet us at any time, hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio, Dr. Tom Shives, along with Tracy McRae, and this week's guest, an expert on diabetes, Dr. Adrian Vella. And of course, this is, November is Diabetes Awareness Month, and that all comes from the American Diabetes Association, and they say we ought to know a little more about this disease because it's a huge problem in this country. Agree with that, Dr. Vella, and by the way, welcome to the program. Great
Thank
to
you.
Have you.
Good morning. Yes, I agree. It is an important disease, and more people should know more about it.
So it's all about blood sugar, right? So tell us what's supposed to happen when we eat sugar.
Well, whenever we eat, usually whatever we eat has some sort of sugar in it or carbohydrate, which is rapidly absorbed and digested into sugar. And the body is actually quite well adapted at handling this. Blood sugar will rise for a little bit, but its rise is contained by the fact that the beta cell produces large amounts of insulin in a very short amount of time.
And these beta cells are in your pancreas, correct?
They are, yes. And they produce large amounts of insulin, which stimulates uptake of glucose by the body.
Glucose, same as blood sugar. And why is it that you don't want too much glucose or sugar hanging out in your blood vessels?
Well, what happens is that sugar sticks to things. And by sticking to various proteins like the blood vessels, it changes them. And it changes them in a way which is not favorable to the body. It causes local inflammation. It affects the function of these proteins. So in simple terms, arteries become harder. Blood flow becomes disrupted. And this ultimately is what leads to the complications of diabetes.
Why is it that in the last 20 to 30 years, there's been a 50% increase in diabetes?
Well, I think the easiest explanation for that is that we have adopted a more sedentary lifestyle. There's more people who are overweight, and there's more abundance of calories. That is the simple explanation. It's a bit more complicated than that, and unfortunately, we don't completely understand.
Does it have anything to do with the way that food is processed, that we eat so much more processed food now, that can more easily be transmitted into glucose?
I doubt that would be the case.
So the underlying basic problem in the relationship between obesity and diabetes is the fact that once you have so much weight on board, once you are so large, your body can't produce enough insulin to handle the blood sugar?
Well, actually, at least in the short term, it does produce enough insulin. What happens is that the body stops responding to the insulin produced. So this term vulgarly is called insulin resistance, i.e. the body is resistant to insulin.
And that has to do with weight?
That has to do with the weight. So initially, at least, production isn't so much of an issue. The body is producing a lot of insulin, just there isn't enough to go around for the conditions prevailing.
And now you talk about, define a couple of terms for us, diabetes and pre-diabetes. There are what, 12 or 13% of the population has diabetes, and that's has to do with the value of the how much blood glucose they have. But so, then you talk about a condition called pre-diabetes.
Yes. So diabetes is an odd disease because it's defined by a lab value, glucose. So a normal fasting glucose ranges between 70 and 100 milligrams per deciliter. And somebody who has a fasting glucose in that range is considered to be normal. Diabetes is said to be present when your blood sugar is consistently above 126 milligrams per deciliter. And in fact, that's part of the reason that diabetes is increasing in incidence is we've changed the rules slightly.
Ah.
We've lowered the threshold at which diabetes is defined.
So you said 120. It used to be 130. Is that right?
It used to be 140.
40. Okay.
But
now it's 126.
The reason for that.
Exact here.
Yes. But that's because it translates to 7 millimoles exactly. And 7 millimoles
for the math.
Is the value.
Yeah. I knew it for
millimoles.
The math.
Yeah. So that's the at a population level. That's where the incidence of diabetic eye disease and diabetic neuropathy increases dramatically. That's the inflection point. That's the reason why 126 was chosen as opposed to 140. So basically, on the one hand, you have up to 100 is normal, 126 is diabetes. The middle ground, okay, the no man's land, is called pre-diabetes. And pre-diabetes is the best, if you have pre-diabetes, it's the best predictor of your developing diabetes.
Warning sign.
Yeah. What percent of people with pre-diabetes develop actual diabetes?
It's an excellent question. So the magic number is about 110, okay? Once your blood sugar is consistently above 110, about 40% will develop diabetes over 10 years.
What about gestational diabetes? Does that lead you to be more likely to be pre-diabetic?
Actually, that's more likely to make you diabetic.
It is.
That's actually a stronger risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have gestational diabetes, your risk is over 50% that you would develop diabetes in later life.
So why do moms that are gestational diabetic, why do they get it with not all of their pregnancies, maybe just one pregnancy? They have multiple children, but they only have gestational diabetes for one kid.
Typically, it's actually with later pregnancies,
mm-hmm.
and that's hand-in-hand with aging.
Okay.
Probably.
That's the difference.
So if you have pre-diabetes, you obviously don't want to get your blood sugar too high. You want to prevent becoming a true diabetic.
That's
by
correct.
Definition. So how do you do that?
Well, so multiple things have been tried. The short answer is that the most effective preventive therapy is diet and exercise.
Diet and exercise.
Yes. So the diabetes prevention program, which is the best study to date to study this question, took people who were at high risk of developing diabetes. So they either had a high history of gestational diabetes, or they had impaired fasting glucose. They were pre-diabetic, and they randomized them to medication or no therapy, other than standard go home, exercise, and eat less. Or else to an intensive program where they would exercise for at least 30 minutes five times a week, together with very easily available dietary advice on a monthly basis. Those people actually decreased their risk for diabetes, for progression for diabetes, very significantly, and that was better than therapy with medication.
Wow. Do they meditate too, or no meditation?
That was not part of the program.
I'm telling you, though, if Dr. Sood was here, he'd say, yes, make that part of it.
Once you develop diabetes, you are stuck with the diagnosis. Myth or matter of fact?
It's somewhere in between, actually.
Okay.
So, as I said, diabetes is defined by the blood sugar. So you can say that you don't have diabetes if your blood sugar is normal. So there are situations, and I've encountered that many a time in my practice, where people present with diabetes. And there are clearly modifiable factors at play. So either they're stress eating, for example, to nod to Dr. Sood. they're eating inappropriate things. They are very, very overweight. And suddenly they become motivated and they lose a lot of weight. The blood sugars return to normal. And they can go for a very, very long time without actually ever having another high blood glucose.
Mm-hmm.
And to all intents and purposes, if you use the definition of high blood sugar requiring therapy, they do not have diabetes anymore. Now, the bigger question is whether the underlying abnormalities that led to their having high blood sugar go away or not. Chances are those abnormalities probably do not go away. So if they regain their weight or return to their bad habits, the high blood sugars would return.
The important thing for everyone to know here is that if you don't control your blood sugar, there are all sorts of complications. And I believe I recently read or heard someone said told us on this program that 50% or more of people who present to the emergency room with a heart attack today have diabetes or pre-diabetes.
Oh, yes. So sometimes it can be very difficult to reliably diagnose diabetes at the time you're having a heart attack, because part of the stress response may actually raise your blood sugars. Mm-hmm. And the more pre-diabetic or diabetic you are, the more likely that's going to happen. But certainly it is a contributing factor in cardiovascular disease. And it's an important, in fact, the treatment of diabetes, especially in its early stages, should focus more on prevention of cardiovascular risk, i.e. lowering your cholesterol, improving your blood pressure, as well as trying to control your blood sugars.
Because it markedly increases your risk for heart disease and stroke.
Most definitely. And you don't want to lose your eye. You don't want to take your eye off the ball, you know, and focus on the blood sugars alone and then neglect the other things, which ultimately are likely to cause morbidity and mortality.
Right. And these are not the only complications. We've got kidney disease and amputations. All the amputations I do are in diabetics. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest and expert on diabetes is Dr. Adrian Vella.
Coming up, this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. And right after that, we'll be talking about diabetic eye disease with eye specialist Dr. Sophie Bakri. And we'll take your phone calls at 507-282-1234, your tweets at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Sleep problems and bladder problems. Lots of people have them, and it turns out that issues with one may cause problems with the other. You see, a report in the Phase B journal shows sleep-wake cycles are connected to the bladder. A sort of built-in clock in your brain controls timers in your body, which in turn control functions such as the bladder. The researchers want to use this information to come up with ways to treat sleep bladder problems, maybe develop treatments to affect circadian rhythm. They say issues like an overactive bladder can really disrupt life, and understanding why it happens may lead to solutions. And now here's news about myeloma. The International Myeloma Working Group has updated the criteria for diagnosing that disease. Multiple myeloma is a blood cancer that forms in a type of white blood cell called a plasma cell. The new criteria means patients may start treatment earlier, before symptoms begin. Here's Mayo Clinic Dr. S. Vincent Rajkumar.
Now we don't need to tell patients that, you know, you probably have myeloma, but we're going to wait till you get kidney failure or bone destruction before we start therapy. Rather, we can use these other biomarkers and imaging tools to initiate therapy before the damage happens. That will improve quality of life. But there's hope that this will actually translate not just into improvement in quality of life, but also into overall survival and potentially pave the way for a cure.
This was published in the journal Lancet Oncology. And the Society of Thoracic Surgeons has also released some new guidelines for practice. They're for treating cancer of the esophagus and where the esophagus meets the stomach. The guidelines mostly address ways to reduce the cancer with things like chemo and radiation before surgery, with the goal of maximizing the chance of a cure. They also say a multidisciplinary team of experts to address each component of care is key. And this was published in the journal Annals of Thoracic Surgery. And finally, the Harvard School of Public Health found if people swap 5% of their calories from saturated fats, you know, things like red meat and butter, with foods with linoleic acid, a type of polyunsaturated fat, they can lower the risk of coronary heart disease events by 9% and lower their risk of death by 13%. Now, foods with that good fat include vegetable oils, nuts, and seeds. Other studies show swapping saturated fat with polyunsaturated fat reduce bad cholesterol levels, so this is more evidence that doing so is good for you. And this was published in the journal Circulation. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know. This week's specialist, a diabetes expert, Dr. Adrian Vella. Coming up, we'll talk more with Dr. Vella. We'll talk to him about newer therapies for patients with diabetes, plus important tests you should have if you do have diabetes. And of course, we, as always, we want you to join our program. 507-282-1234 is our telephone program, our telephone number. Or you can tweet us anytime at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll get to your calls in just a couple of minutes. But guess who's on the line?
Yeah, to begin this segment, we're joined by diabetes and retina eye specialist, Dr. Sophie Bakri. She is live from the Mayo Clinic Retina Eye Conference. Good morning, Dr. Bakri.
Good morning, Tracy.
Hey, good morning. Nice to have you on the program, a mother of twins.
Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, she's on maternity leave, but she's working hard today. I love it. Well, Dr. Bakri, one of the things I've learned over the years is that sometimes an eye doctor is the first person that will know that someone has diabetes. Why is that?
Well, I think that's because patients haven't sought routine care from a primary medical care perspective. And it's certainly very disappointing when, as ophthalmologists, we discover that somebody has diabetes, because often those eyes are really, they're really far gone.
What does it do? What does diabetes do to our eyes?
So in the early stages, it creates tiny hemorrhages in the retina, and you may have no symptoms whatsoever. But when people seek treatment, it's because they usually have symptoms, and at that point, things can look pretty bad. The hemorrhages can be very large. They may even have retinal detachments, and they may even have high eye pressure if it's an extreme case.
So diabetes affects the blood vessels of the eyes just like the blood vessels in other parts of the body. And when you say hemorrhage, you mean you get some bleeding because one of these blood vessels bursts or bleeds? Is that what you mean?
Well, what happens is the eye starts to make new blood vessels because there is a lack of oxygen flow to the retina. So as a response, the eye tries to make these new blood vessels, but they're not the same quality as the ones that you would like. So they start to be fragile and bleed right into the eye.
Okay, and when you say retina, you're talking the back of the eye, like the film of a camera.
Correct.
Okay.
And now I have a myth or matter of fact. Do people with diabetes eventually go blind?
Sometimes, but usually not, because these days the primary care is excellent and the ophthalmological care is excellent. So really, there's no reason for a diabetic to go blind.
So now when you say the primary care is excellent, you mean that someone has gone to their family physician and had their blood glucose checked so they know if they have diabetes so it can be treated or they can get it under control with diet and exercise?
Absolutely. Okay. Early detection and treatment is the key.
And so we were saying earlier that it is Diabetes Awareness Month, and it is also Diabetic Eye Disease Awareness Month. So I would say that must mean that we have quite an increase in both of those things over the years. Has eye complications, diabetic eye complications, become a bigger problem over the years?
I actually think they've become less of a problem.
Good.
Because patients are seeking early diagnosis and treatment, but also the treatments that we have are now a lot better.
Makes a big difference.
So what can you do for someone who has so-called diabetic retinopathy? You say the treatment is better. How do you treat these patients who have already developed the problem?
So it depends on the stage of the disease, and there are several treatments and several sequences of treatments. But one of the really effective treatments is laser therapy, where we put a couple of thousand laser spots in the periphery of the retina, and that shrinks down the blood vessels.
The ones that would otherwise potentially bleed.
Correct, the unwanted ones. And then sometimes there's leakage into the retina, what we call macular edema, because the capillaries are just very leaky in diabetics. And we can inject the eye about once a month with medications that decrease that leakage.
The capillaries are the tiny blood vessels that you're talking about in the back of the eye.
Correct, and they happen to be right in the very center in the macula.
Okay. And now, is this laser procedure an office procedure?
Yes, it is.
Wow. Well, Dr. Bakri, we'll let you get back to your retina conference, but we have to know, is there anything that is breaking news from the retina eye conference? What's new in the world of retinas?
We're discussing new injections that have been approved for the treatment of this edema or swelling in the back of the retina. We're also discussing new surgical probes and techniques. So it's quite an exciting time.
You have your husband, Sanj Kakkar, one of my colleagues, an orthopedic surgeon. Is he taking care of the babies?
He's home.
I bet he's not alone. Well, congratulations on your rapidly expanding family, Dr. Bakri, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tracy, and thank you, Tom.
Yeah, bye-bye. You bet. Good to talk to you. All right, Dr. Adrian Vella, let's get back to diabetes in general, and let's talk about some important things that diabetics need to do, some important tests that they need to have. And by the way, our telephone number, phone lines are open, 507-282-1234.
What are some of the things that people should get, tests that should be run?
Well, I think, obviously, fasting glucose is probably one of the more important tests.
Fasting means you haven't eaten for what, 12 hours?
Probably 6 hours is enough, actually. Okay. But 12 hours would be a reasonable time. And the other test is called a hemoglobin A1C. The hemoglobin A1C is like the batting average of your blood sugars over the previous 3 months. Okay?
3 months?
Yes. So blood sugars, glucose, as I said earlier, sticks to things. And when it sticks to things, it can cause trouble. However, it also sticks to red blood cells. It doesn't cause any harm by doing that, but it basically gives us something we can measure.
Oh.
And since red blood cells, on average, have a life in the circulation of about 120 days, this A1C, the amount of glucose that's stuck to hemoglobin, gives us an average of the glycemic exposure of the body.
If you have a question, give us a call, 507-282-1234, or you can tweet hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. And I have a question that I want to pose from Nido, who wants to know, says, I was diagnosed pre-diabetic 2 months back. Now my fasting blood sugar, is that resting blood sugar? Is that what that is? Both normal after dietary changes. Am I still considered pre-diabetic?
It's a difficult question to answer. So again, strictly speaking, if you go by the definition of glucose, no. However, it's the trajectory over a period of time, mm-hmm. which is important. So if you make it a habit, as I do, of looking at somebody's blood sugars, fasting blood sugars over the years, and, you know, we're lucky we practice in a place where it's very easy to see that trajectory just by bringing up all the lab values, you can make up your mind as to whether the trajectory is stable, upward or downward.
Sure. And you'd like every patient to be like Nido.
Correct. I would. I would. The question is what it's going to be like in 6 months' time or 1 year's time or 10 years' time.
All right. Phone lines are open. 507-282-1234. Your questions on diabetes from a Mayo Clinic expert.
Another tweet from someone saying, am I diabetic if I go to the bathroom if a lot? Frequent peeing in a day is specifically how they said it. Does that make you diabetic? Is that a sign that you're diabetic?
It could be. Mm-hmm. There are many reasons why that could happen.
Sure.
But hopefully that's not the way diabetes presents, just as hopefully it's not the way that, diabetics present with eye disease. And it's certainly less common nowadays, but it can be one of the ways in which diabetes presents.
And another tweet was, are there apps for diabetes? This person, there's even a hashtag about social diabetes on Twitter. So that's something I've never even known about before. So are there some apps that diabetics can use?
There are apps.
Wow.
There are some apps that are applicable to everybody, okay? And they're basically designed to help you count calories, for example, or else to monitor your activity. So if you're wearing an activity monitor, step counter like Fitbit, there are various brands, okay? These apps can interact with these devices to measure your activity and measure how many calories you're burning. And then there are many other apps which help you count the amount of calories you're eating. There are some specialized apps that have been developed either by universities or by drug companies, for example, which help you count carbs or help guide insulin dosing, for example. Then one of my colleagues is actually trying to help with the development of an artificial pancreas, where basically the app on your phone will tell you how much insulin you should be giving.
Because it's hooked into your artificial pancreas.
Well, yes, that would be that's the long-term goal. Yes.
Wow.
Incredible, isn't it?
We have a phone call, 507-282-1234. Paul has a question about eye question. Go right ahead, Paul.
Yes, my name is Paul, and I have confirmed diabetes. It's under control. I'm taking medication for it, and my blood pressure is low and everything. And a year ago, I had the diabetic retinopathy scan of my eye,
mm-hmm.
and everything was normal or was there. But in the past 5 to 6 days, I can't get in to see my ophthalmologist, but I have a little floater in the eye, and I'm just wondering if the either high blood pressure or the sugar level or something could cause this little floater.
It's been hanging around for 5 or 6 days?
Yes.
Okay.
And I don't know. I was just kind of wondering if my condition could have caused that, or is it something else, just an eye floater?
It would probably be just an eye floater. If you've had an eye exam a year ago and there was no evidence of diabetic eye disease, although we recommend that people with diabetes get an eye exam every year,
mm-hmm.
It is unlikely that sight-threatening changes occur within 1 year if you've had a normal eye exam a year before.
Okay.
Right. Thanks for calling in, Paul.
Yeah, that normal eye exam, I think, is reassuring, right, Dr. Vella?
It is.
So the other a couple of things that you have on your list of important tests for diabetes. Oh, but I wanted to ask you one thing about Paul said, you know, I'm on treatment for diabetes. He didn't say he was on insulin. So obviously there must be some treatment for diabetes that isn't insulin. And can you explain that to us?
Oh, certainly. There are several medications that are available for diabetes. And actually, in the past 10 years, there's been a proliferation with four new classes of drugs that are available for diabetes. The first medication for diabetes that was utilized, they're loosely called oral hypoglycemic agents because they're taken by mouth and they cause you to lower your blood sugars. And those are, originally at least, they were derivatives of sulfonamide antibiotics. They were discovered during the Second World War, came into use in the late 50s, and are still quite an important part of therapy of diabetes. The other class of medications is metformin, which is used probably as the first-line agent for the treatment of diabetes, and has been around for as long as I've been on this planet, basically.
No kidding.
Safe and actually quite effective.
I do have a myth or matter of fact. It's the one that we talked about at the very beginning of the show. We said obesity is, you know, such a big problem, such a big risk factor for diabetes. Obese children at sometimes grow up, and if they're teenagers, they're no longer obese. So the question, the myth or matter of fact, children can outgrow diabetes. Is that a myth or is that a fact?
It's probably more a myth. So most of the children with diabetes that we see in this part of the world have type 1 diabetes, which is immune-mediated destruction of the pancreas, which produces insulin. And unfortunately, that people do not grow out of.
Okay. But type 2 you can grow out of?
So children with type 2 diabetes, usually it's in the setting of quite extreme obesity and poor diet. And that, to some extent, can be improved and ameliorated. I would stop short of saying that you've grown out of it.
Okay.
You know, the earlier you start out with diabetes, the more likely over time you will need more therapy, such as insulin. So if you're a child and or adolescent and you have type 2 diabetes, it's difficult to know the long term.
We briefly explain, the difference between type 1 and type 2 diabetes for our listeners.
I'm sorry, I should have said that. So diabetes is broadly categorized into two groups, type 1 diabetes versus type 2 diabetes. Now, like most classifications, this is extremely arbitrary. And we can talk in terms of stereotypes to describe what each category is. But there is some overlap, and sometimes it can be very difficult to distinguish between the two. So if we talk stereotypes, type 1 diabetes is what happens to children, develops at a young age. It's got nothing to do with obesity. It's caused usually by immune destruction of the pancreas.
So maybe they can't make insulin. Their pancreas can't does make not insulin. Make insulin.
They will be dependent on insulin forever. Okay. Type 2 diabetes at the extreme stereotype type part of the spectrum usually occurs in late middle age and is associated with obesity and a sedentary lifestyle, and it can be managed with diet and weight loss and perhaps oral medications. People might require insulin, but insulin is not necessary for life. That's the stereotype.
All right, thank you.
We have about 90 seconds to go. We need to talk about what's on the horizon, new therapies that are available.
Well, I mentioned that there are a couple of classes of drugs that have become available in the past 10 years. And in fact, there's one class which got approved about a year ago, the SGLT2 inhibitors. Mm-hmm. So there are multiple pharmacotherapeutic interventions for diabetes. In terms of type 1 diabetes, I think what's available is a proliferation of technology which has made controlling diabetes easier. Pumps, sensors to measure glucose on a continuous basis, and now technology to try and make sensors talk to pumps. So that's the artificial pancreas. But and then pancreas transplantation or pancreas replacement is tantalizingly visible on the horizon, I would say.
What about islet transplants?
Yeah, so that's what I was getting at.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what about genetics in diabetics? We have about a minute left.
Well, genetics actually has been a tool to try and understand how people develop diabetes, mm-hmm. and it actually has helped with the discovery of diabetes, of new therapies for diabetes and new pathways that are involved in the pathogenesis of diabetes. In terms of individual risk prediction, it hasn't been that useful. And that's because most of the genes predisposing to diabetes actually have very small effects on risk of diabetes. So in you or me, it's nothing compared to weighing, 100 pounds overweight, mm-hmm. in terms of risk predisposition.
You know, we're not going to be able to get to Chuck's phone call, but his question has to do with the fact that he had his blood glucose tested and it was 100. We call that normal, right?
We would call that normal. We would need, never satisfied, we'd need to know that it's still normal in a year's time.
Yeah, it's Chuck. And sorry we didn't get your phone call, Chuck, but you are normal.
Let's the ways that. To prevent adult onset diabetes, what's the best way?
The two keys.
Well, lose weight and exercise.
Excellent. Yeah. That's it?
Diet and exercise. That's what you need to know. Dr. Adrian Vella, diabetes expert at the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota. Thanks so much for being with us. Really appreciate you being here. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program, and it's exciting. We're talking about the Heart Summit and heart disease with two Mayo Clinic experts. Stay with us.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Well, we've just finished our program on diabetes. We've got a little more information for our listeners.
That's right. We just, have so much to pack in there. If you go to mayoclinic.com, there is a diabetes center that you can click on for all sorts of other information. And we didn't even say there is the Mayo Clinic Essential Diabetes book and the Essential Diabetes Diet book and journal that you can get from Mayo Clinic as well.
Everything you need to know if you have diabetes.
That's
and thanks
right.
again to Dr. Adrian Vella.
Now, just like Dr. Bakri is at that Retina Eye Conference, we've got a Heart Summit that is coming up here in Rochester on Monday and Tuesday. And then next week, we're going to talk about some of the things that they've learned at that.
Right. We'll visit with heart specialist Dr. Rakesh Suri and Dr. Charles Bruce. And there's all sorts of exciting things going on in the field of heart disease. You know, replacing or repairing someone's heart valve through a blood vessel is an absolute modern day marvel. We'll find out how they do it. And we'll also give you an update on regenerative medicine. You know, they can actually, I think now, inject stem cells into your heart and repair damaged weak heart. Absolutely incredible. We'll talk all about it next week with our heart specialist guests.
It's repair, replace, and regenerate. We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, visit our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, for a podcast of today's program and previous episodes. Also, go to mayoclinic.org, where over 3,000 physicians, scientists, and researchers will share their expertise to empower you to manage your health.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich. Our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine. Our technical director, Kim David. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and diabetic specialist Dr. Adrian Vella, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.